How Little Soya is taking a soy sauce brand and competing with the big guys. Welcome to Global from Asia, number 98.
Welcome to the Global from Asia podcast, where the daunting process of running an international business from Hong Kong is broken down into straight up actionable advice. And now, your host, Michael Michelini.
Welcome to Global from Asia, episode number 98. I want to start today off with our thoughts and prayers for those in Tianjin, China. Quite a tragedy there with the massive container ship explosion last Wednesday night, which is still pretty unreal to me just watching it on videos as I'm a four-hour flight or more away. But my friend and guest on this show, Russell Smith, back from episode number 81, was actually in the building complex next door. He's totally fine. I spoke with him on Thursday on WeChat, and he was evacuating as he felt all these burning materials and chemicals was potentially not good for him. So I believe he's on his way to Thailand now. Let's keep our thoughts and prayers in for the firefighters and everyone else that were in Tianjin for that explosion. It's really, really a tragedy. We got Russell on the line here. Thought it would be pretty cool to patch you into our show today, just to hear the. I'm sure listeners have heard on the TV and we've seen some video, but you were there, right?
Sure thing. So I was living in one of the. If you've seen the videos of the explosion, you can see the flames crashing down over some apartment buildings. I was living there, basically. Our apartment block was about 900 meters from the center of the blast. And, you know, we were lucky, to be honest, that we were like six or seven buildings back. The ones at the front were torched, like blown through. And honestly, like, my wife, all the local people, they've got together in WeChat groups. And they're trying to find the people who lived in the front, and most of them haven't been accounted for, which you don't hear about on the news. Like, they're not really. I think they're playing down the numbers. Anyway, most of those people haven't been found. We were lucky. Like, our apartment faced actually away from the blast. So we didn't realize. Actually, we had no idea what was happening. I'll go from the top. It was about 11:30 at night, and we were just sat watching some TV shows. And the first thing we heard, it sounded kind of like thunder. And I just remember thinking, you know, oh, that's a bit weird. You know, it's not. But then a few seconds later, boom, there's this huge explosion. And I just thought, what could that be? Like, there's no explanation for that. I thought it's someone gas gone, or it sounded like a bomb. You know, it sounded like someone was attacking. So we went to the window, and all we can see on the opposite building was like flames dancing in their windows. And I just thought, what's happened over there? You know, that building must have gone up. Because I, you know, no idea. And the next thing we knew, just earth-shattering blast. The whole building rocked. It was like the end of the world, you know. And the building shook backward and forward. The power went down. The windows blew through. Just unbelievable. And in our minds, what could it possibly be? You live in like quite a quiet area, you know. And an earthquake. So anyway, the first thing is like, we got to get out. And kind of a bit panicked, you know, and I don't remember going to the office. I did go to the office. I grabbed my keys, I grabbed my cash, and at some point I made my wife get some clothes on. I don't remember, but she told me that happened. And then I remember we like rushed the door in the dark and we were scrambling to open it, real panic, and we got the door open, and when we got out into the corridor, broken glass all over the floor, the stairwell, the doors had just blown completely through. But actually we kind of panicked because we tried to open the door. And half the door was blown off, obviously all attached, but the handle was free and we couldn't open the door. And that was the first time I was really scared because we just thought, oh my God. But then Arminius had installed two stairwells, which so we rushed over, we got into there, and then we realized so much glass on the floor, our feet being cut, so we actually made a decision to go back, get our shoes. And actually at that moment, it was the real moment that I thought, this might be the end of my life, like, I don't know, no idea what was going on. Felt like the building was going to fall down, and I just thought, that's it. But we got the shoes on, we rushed to the well, and like it was weird outside. There was like explosions and fire, and we just like there's no comprehension what it could possibly be, except everything's just blown up. Anyway, we just made it down the stairs. I carried her half the way, and we didn't see any other people, which was really weird. We could hear like shouts and screams and just glimpses out the window of all the other buildings destroyed too. Anyway, when we got to the ground floor, we saw that the whole of the front of the building had been blown out. And then when we got outside, it was just really weird because all the windows were blown, people's belongings on the floor. It was just quite incomprehensible. We just kept going, kept going. We got out. And then we got out to the front of the Xiaochu, and there was a fair few people out there, like a few hundred. And, you know, not too many people injured, but, there was people with blood on them and everyone was out there half naked. I didn't have a top. I just had keys and cash. And it was weird, man. And only after that, when we were stood outside, we looked back and saw the huge plumes of smoke. And still just hadn't, what's going on over there? We had no idea. We stuck around for about half an hour and there was no police, no fire engine. Like, what's happening? We didn't realize at the time the whole area had gone up, you know? And like fire engines were in a different place, and they were trying to get in because we lived near a highway, so all the trucks were coming off the highway right there, and it was completely gridlocked, so like the fire engines and police couldn't get in. It was chaos, really, like pretty crazy. And we were lucky, like my parents-in-law lived across town, so we stuck around for a bit. There's not a lot we could really do. And then we took a few friends and we went back there, and first thing in the morning, 4:30, we didn't sleep. I couldn't sleep at all. We went back, we took the gas masks and we went back to the scene of the crime. We went upstairs, I grabbed my stuff, man, laptop, phone, bit of clothes, like whatever we could grab. Locked the door because I left the door wide open when we ran out first time. Really worried about thieves going in, like taking all the stuff. But we got like the important things, and now the whole area is cordoned off. Like you can't go near that side of town, to be honest. And you know, when we walked out, we walked for like 3 or 4 blocks, and even 3 or 4 blocks away, the buildings are blown, even on the ground floor. And there's no like clear path through, like for the blast, but like the ground floor, all the banks were blown out, and the local shopping center, the swimming pool, like all the cafes destroyed, man. Just crazy. Real crazy.
That is like.
Yeah, well, now we're off. I've got a flight. I've got a flight. Book to Gwaili at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Yeah, good thing, man.
I'm lucky to be alive, man. Lucky to be alive. It's like, in the position before, I thought this actually could be the end of the life.
That's crazy.
Terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, it make you appreciate life a lot. A lot, I think, right?
Absolutely, so. Man. This made us think, like, why are we out here again? Like, both of us, we're free to move, location independent, so we're here because we're supposed to have family for now, but like we got to get out, you know. And we're trying to get out, so they're kind of stubborn, you know. That it won't be so much problem. They kind of believe news on TV that like the air's not so bad, but a lot of reports coming out like about sodium cyanide. Yeah. And honest, so I don't know if you know much about the truth about what was it, but it seems to me that actually a fire started at about 10:40. The fire trucks went in, and they were there for like almost up to like 45 minutes. Then a huge blast, and it turns out sodium cyanide. I don't know if this is true or not, but this is like the best like information that's out there. Seems to be like when you spray water on it, it ignites. And you know, they were there for 40 minutes, and then this huge. I don't think people knew it was there or something. I don't know. Doesn't feel too good to be here now, man.
Get out.
They're warning about the water. Get out. People are stocking up on like bottled water. So, yeah, man. Time for a change of scenery.
Yeah, stay safe, and hopefully you can convince your family to make a move.
Yeah, man. No worries. Words of advice, like, just check when you book into an apartment, just ask if there's any like dangerous chemical storage next door. So
crazy, man. That's
we're
really
out of there, man. Out of there.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing, Russ. Well, let's try to keep our spirits high and remember life is short and we need to appreciate every day that we are on this little earth of ours. So today's guest is an upbeat and fun guy to have on the show, Gary Murphy from Little Soya, a veteran entrepreneur with lots of business experience and an expert in sales, shares with us how he went from almost opening a bar in Shanghai to starting a soy sauce business a few years ago that has the big guys noticing. And also after the interview, I'm going to have a small announcement about the show scheduling. So if you want, stick with me after. Let's get into this. So today we have with us Gary Murphy, dialing from Texas, right?
Correct. Houston, Texas,
USA. Houston, Texas, USA. So yeah, we've been in touch for a few years now, quite a few years, and still haven't had a chance to meet. We've had some, tried to make some coordinations, but hasn't happened yet. But glad to get you on the show today and dig in a little bit about your business, and we can also even have a little bit of chat too. So maybe first, do you want to introduce yourself to everybody?
Sure. So as Mike said, my name is Gary Murphy. I live here in Houston, Texas. I've been an entrepreneur my entire life, at least the last 26 years. I started, I guess, 7 different companies during that time period with 5 failures, 2 successes. And I'm currently CEO of a soy sauce company here in Houston. At least it's based in Houston. Got a staff of 8 employees across the U.S. and then 1 full-time in Shanghai.
Awesome.
Soy sauce product that sells to hotels, restaurants, casinos, airlines, that sort of thing.
Yeah. But
yeah, so I've been going back and forth to China since 2002. It was my first trip. And, I've been back and forth. I guess my last trip was my 9th trip, so coming up on my 10th one, which might be next month. I'm not sure yet. So awesome. If it is, if time permits and if travel permits, we can meet up.
Yeah, that would be amazing. Yeah, because we've been in touch with social media, and before we started recording, you were asking me. I came here 07, my first time ever, and I'm usually in the south most of the time. I've been in the south of China, like a little bit of Shanghai and Beijing, but mostly in Hong Kong and Shenzhen area. So cool. And
It was interesting because you went over there. Let's see. I had just moved to, like I said, I was born in Houston and had most of my businesses here, but in late 2007, I moved to Las Vegas for a couple of years. And, but right before that, had kind of some crazy ups and downs, but right before that, I'd owned a bar and lounge in Houston, sold that, and then I was going to open a nightclub and restaurant with a couple partners in Shanghai, actually.
Wow.
And went back and forth with them, a couple of partners. They were arguing about if they wanted to open it in Suzhou, mainly for expats, or if they wanted to make it more high profile in Shanghai, and anyway, the deal kind of fell through. But yeah, I guess it was about that time or shortly thereafter, I must have saw you online and thought, what is this crazy American doing living over there? And because at that time, I was about to move to Shanghai if I was going to open that nightclub and restaurant. But unfortunately, it didn't happen. But I've still thought about it one day when things settle down. But who knows? But so, I mean, even though you're interviewing me, I'm very curious. Just
sure.
What brought you to China? And then really, most importantly, how did you decide to stay for all these years? That's a long time.
Yeah. So I came. It's funny you said bar. I was selling bar products for many years online, like cocktail shakers and bottle openers since 2004, mostly online, eBay, Amazon, my website, and I was sourcing from China some of the products. So originally I didn't plan to move here, but I was having trouble, you know, coordinating with suppliers, and it wasn't just my e-commerce business, but a lot of people were asking me how do they get the products from China too, like other bar product kind of suppliers and distributors. I was in industry. I was going to like the nightclub and bar show and Atlantic City bar show and New York bar show and networking like that. So I came out here for a month in October during a trade show season. And thought I would just come here just to, you know, take a first trip and get to know the place. But I don't want to say fell in love with, but I like the energy and there was just so much to learn. And I got friends saying, well, you could live here. I was like, I can live here? I thought you could only visit. But then I realized you could live here. So then I went back to the States for the holidays in 07. But then right after Christmas, like Christmas Day, the day after, I flew back to China to live. And never knew how long I would be here. But it's funny now I'm like married with a kid and planning a long term here. But there were some ups and downs. Like, you know, sometimes I think everybody has those China time when they can't take it anymore. And I thought I had that a couple of times, but I keep coming back and sticking with it.
And so your family's here in the U.S. What city are they in?
So, yeah, like I was born and raised in Northeast in Connecticut, you know, but my parents retired to Florida. And so I have family, sisters like up in Minnesota now. So, you know, I'm all family's still in Northeast U.S. and sisters in the Midwest and my parents are in Florida. So I don't know what to say anymore, but usually I guess I
spend- And how do they take it with you living there for so long? I mean, I remember when I moved to Las Vegas just for the couple of years, and I'm very close to my family. So it was, you know, it was pretty hard to do, but we were at least in the same country. So if I wanted to go home, it was a, you know, 2.5 hour flight, but it's not quite that easy with you. I mean, after a while, they just, or even you just understand that's just part of life. And
yeah, it's really hard. I'm going back in September for a few weeks. So I try to make it once a year or once every year and a half or so. But yeah, it's really, that's always the hardest thing. You know, I can deal with some of the bad food or the, you know, the risks of, you know, pollution and other issues. But, yeah, the hardest thing is family and friends, but, it gets easier over time. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but, even a lot of times in the U.S., like, friends and family kind of get distant and don't see each other so often, even if they're in the same area. I mean, I know it depends on the family, but, you know, I was back about a year and a half ago, and I was even in a city where I grew up in to hang out with people, but it was just like a Friday night party was all I could get, even though I was there for like 5 days, because everybody's caught up in their career, and so I couldn't really even spend time with people because they were so busy. So
that's an interesting comment. Yeah, it's like you fly back, you know, 8,000 miles to see people, and they're maybe 5 or 10 miles away from you, and yet they're too busy.
Exactly. Crazy.
But now you've got your new family there with married to Chinese girl, and you have a new baby that I think I've seen online a couple of times now, right?
Yeah. I'm always wondering how much to share them, but yeah, I put some photos on there for sure.
So that's awesome.
Yeah, a bit over a year now. So it's it's pretty awesome new life for me, and I'm embracing it fully. It's pretty cool.
Cool. So your little one will be Chinese citizenship, I guess?
No, we went with the U.S. Can't be both. It has to be one or the other.
Okay. So born in the U.S. and then went back to China.
Oh, no, he was born in China, but...
Interesting. I'll catch up on that later with you.
Yeah, sure. I can give you the full story. But yeah... All right, so let's get into business a little bit. So yeah, I've had you on my list to get on the show for a while. So, you know, we talk about business in Asia and China, and you know, I'm curious to know. Yeah, I mean, there's so many businesses, and maybe we just focus on the current one. But yeah, I like Little Soya. I've always been following your, especially Instagram. You have some fun photos, and it's a very visual. You're very good with the visual branding, and. A lot of trade shows, and it's pretty cool. So I'm also curious, how did that, so then you were almost gonna do a Shanghai nightclub or Suzhou nightclub, but that didn't go through, and then Little Soya came up, or what was the story?
The story is, and I'm asked that question a lot, you know, we've with my company now as a fast moving startup, I guess, you know, we've been through 2.5 rounds of funding. So I've got, 47 investors that I've brought on, $2 million. And so as I'm out there pitching my story, and I probably pitched it 500, 600 times to potential investors. And that's probably one of the top three questions that ever comes up is, how soy sauce, or why Little Soya, or of all possible businesses, how did that come about? And kind of the short answer, without taking up too much of our interview time here, but, is kind of what I said earlier. I have been going back and forth to China for the past 13 years. When I took my first trip in 2002, at the time I was CEO of a company called Mach 5. It was a courier messenger delivery legal services company. And I was a member of a CEO roundtable group in Houston at the time that offered a 10-day trade mission to China to learn how to do business with China. And I had kind of low expectations. I didn't have any plans to do business with China. I'd only read about it in books or seen it, on TV and that sort of thing. And I went for my first trip, and kind of like you did, I kind of fell in love with the country, with the people, with culture, with, learning and comparing, right off the bat that it was a 5,000-year-old culture or more compared to U.S. And then I wound up dating my Chinese English translator that I met on my first trip, dated her just by text message and email for about a year, mainly email. And then went back to see her about a year later, 2003. And even though we split up at that time, she just taught me a lot about China, a lot about the culture. We had hours and hours together that I just got to learn about the country. And I just told myself at that time that one day I would do business with China. I wasn't really sure what that meant. It was just a feeling, probably more so. And then kind of as the years went on, it worked out that right after that, I'd sold that business, opened the bar and restaurant, had that for a couple of years. That fell through, got the offer to go to China to open the restaurant that I mentioned. That fell through, came back to U.S., got a phone call from a friend who said there was a position to work in one of the big hotels in Las Vegas. And I didn't have any experience whatsoever with being a project manager of a big hotel. But my friend said, look, you got business background. Just come here and interview. They'll give you the job and you can move to Vegas. So I thought, okay, sure. Why not? Let me go check it out. So I went to Vegas. This is in early 2007, and interviewed, and thought that I killed the interview, thought that I did great. But they later told me that I was overqualified for the position. And I was like, what is overqualified? I was like, just make me an offer and I'll move over here. But they wouldn't hire me. But that was my catalyst to move to Vegas, because there was tons of energy at that time in Vegas. This is a year or so before the market crash. So there was billions of dollars flowing through Vegas, and they all needed products. And most of the products were from China. So I started a China sourcing company called Arista Global in 2008. And so I had a business partner in Houston who had a small office in Shanghai, where he had a staff of, I think he just had two employees, and then he had just a couple employees in Houston. So they were kind of my back end logistics, and I was kind of the front end. So built the website, started it out of my, apartment in my kitchen table, and started getting some pretty big accounts from the big hotel casinos, selling a little bit of glass, granite, furniture, salt and pepper shakers, chopsticks, you name it. So, so that kind of went on for, several months, and we were starting to do well and bringing products in into Vegas, specifically into Las Vegas only.
Awesome.
Probably within 6 or 8 months of me starting that company, the market started to crash. The financial market started to crash around the world, and I started to lose pretty much all of my accounts. They just stopped ordering, except for one particular account that had it was a senior vice president for Harrah's Casinos that owned Caesar's Palace Casino that had wanted to find the best soy sauce in the world in a single use packet for their big buffet that they were about to open. And they had hired a Japanese consulting firm thinking that they were going to find it in Japan.
Interesting.
Of course, we all know that China invented soy sauce, about 3,500 years ago was the first documented proof of it, and perhaps even longer. But so they hired me, but they said the product can be from anywhere but China. From Japan, so that more from a marketing standpoint than a taste or quality. And I told him up front, I said, look, I said, I can check Japan, but I can guarantee you the best product's going to come from China. No, can't come from China. So I said, all right, fine. But I did bring in samples from China, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, Taiwan, Thailand, you name it. And I found a region of China in Guangdong province, actually, that had already been making a high quality soy sauce for quite some time in a single use packet, regular sodium, not real healthy, but awfully good tasting, premium in single use. And I started selling those packets to Caesar's Palace that was buying 50,000 units at a time, or their first order was 50,000 little single use fish packets, fish shaped packets.
Awesome.
And they ordered 50,000 more. 3 months later, ordered 50,000 more. And the orders kind of never stopped coming. So, again, probably after 6 or 7 months, my other orders were all drying up. And that order was still moving along. At the time, I really wasn't going to turn it into a real company regarding the soy sauce. It was just that I knew that Caesars was ordering. Then I wound up moving back to Houston. That's where, my home base is as far as business contacts and family and that sort of thing. And when I got back to Houston, I was going to open like a social media business consulting type company, more higher level, charging $100-$150 an hour or something like that. And picked up a few clients, was kind of moving that along. And my mother mentioned to me that maybe if Las Vegas likes your soy sauce so much, maybe, you might want to think about selling it in Houston. So kind of speed up the story. I took a handful of samples to several high-end sushi restaurants. All of them wanted it. Took it to a bunch of grocery stores. All of them said, get your packaging right and we'll buy it. So I put a small investment team together at the time. I was just going to raise a couple $100,000. That turned into $500,000. And hired a few staff. My father is my CFO and COO.
Nice.
Handles logistics and warehousing here in Houston. And then we started to blow up across the country. So we grew to about 1,800 grocery stores, maybe just about 50 or 100 restaurants. And then we noticed, after about a year to year and a half, that it's incredibly difficult to make money in the grocery business with just one product. Everyone kind of has their handout, the distributors, the brokers, the stores, the customers. Kind of our joke after a while was, can we make some money too? Everyone but us.
Yeah, I've been there. Totally. Yeah, especially with like, international businesses, like everywhere you're paying out somebody somewhere has some kind of a fee, and especially importing and then warehousing and then distributions. Crazy.
Yeah. Like even the brief conversation that you and I had a while back when you were going to help me source something over there. And, I won't get into the full story, but it's like, okay, if we were able to buy that one particular size bottle, get it to the US, and my margin probably starts at about 30 or 40%. But after everyone cuts out of that, I'm looking at maybe 5% that I'm making.
Yeah.
So it's like, geez. But point is, even though grocery was not profitable for us, but it got our name out there big time from coast to coast in the U.S. And top chefs at restaurants, in many different restaurants and hotels, would pick up a pack of our little single-use packets and taste it. And we started getting calls for requests for a low sodium version. Then we'd get requests for a low sodium gluten-free version, which we didn't have either. But we noticed that the restaurants that really no large distributors in the U.S. had a single-use packet of a healthier, low-sodium or gluten-free or non-GMO product. And so we went ahead and developed that with the help of our factory in China and really started to switch over to the food service sector. So today, we're about 99% focused on food service. So food service, again, meaning hotels, restaurants, airline, cruise ship, anywhere where you're selling in bulk. So we've got about 1,000 or so of those customers. Interestingly, a distributor in Panama started buying our 20-liter boxes of soy sauce about 6 months ago. So we just started selling to the Panamanian market. Wow. And yeah, so it's just kind of just grown and grown. And our largest competitors is kind of an interesting comment that our four largest competitors are all, well, three of them are Japanese, one of them is Chinese, but the top three Japanese, they're old companies. I mean, compared to American companies, you know, Kikkoman, which is basically the largest soy sauce company in the world, $5 billion in sales last year, about 325 years old. Yamasa, another competitor, they're about 420 years old, $2 billion. And then Sanjay's, 230 years old. And then Little Soya is, approximately four and a half. So anyway.
David and Goliath or something here?
Yeah, big time. Every day, every night.
Awesome. Yeah, it's really, there's so much here we can go on. It's a really cool story. So I'm trying to think of our listeners here, and I think a lot are entrepreneurs like us, and they're maybe wondering how'd you get those deals with, like, you sound like a pretty good experienced salesperson, but maybe any tips on how some of the entrepreneurs listening want to get into sourcing and trading could get some kind of clients like that? Or
yeah, so like the clients that I'd started with in Vegas, I really spent probably 2 or 3 months of time when I started that company, as I learned from a business mentor of mine many years ago, the phrase is to become a student of your industry. And that particular business mentor of mine drilled it into our heads to study, research as much as humanly possible the market and who your potential customers are, really before you start the business, not start the business and then start hoping and praying that you're going to get a customer. So I probably spent probably 3 months, maybe 4 months of time identifying who I thought might be good customers. And then I started asking a lot of questions, because in sales, it's the phrase of, everyone wants to buy, but nobody wants to be sold to. So, with a lot of these big customers, if you just go up to them immediately and say, okay, I got this great product, let me send you my price sheet and please buy from me, and then of course they're wanting to know immediately, okay, are you cheaper? Are you better? And matter of fact, get in line because 1,000 people want our business. But kind of the approach that I took with these really big companies was to, if I could identify one or two of their staff that I could start asking questions. And I always like to ask the question, and this is before I had started the sourcing company, asking them the questions, if I was to start a company like this, would you buy from me? Or if I was to start a sourcing company, bringing in products from the U.S., what products do you already use right now that you source from China that you might consider allowing me to bid on? And, so it just kind of just starts the conversation with them. And then about the time that I opened the company, of course, then I went back to them and said, okay, I've started the sourcing company. Here's my card. Here's my website. Here's my list of services. And then I pretty much said, look, I know you don't plan on switching over to me right away because you're already happy with your current source, whoever it is, but pick out 2 or 3 of your highest volume products that you'd love to save some money on. and maybe I can save you money, maybe I can't. And I remember this one fairly high level buyer for a big casino in Vegas. We were sitting in his office and I asked him that exact question, thinking that he was about to kick me out of his office because I thought he's probably tired of listening to me talk. Instead, he says, you know what? Follow me. And we went straight to one of their kitchens, one of their large kitchens there in the hotel. We went straight to a back room. He probably handed me about 20 to 25 different products that they currently use that he wanted a better price on. And out of the 25, I think we wind up getting two of the two sold, you know, of a
awesome. Few
products. So, and just to kind of segue a little bit off that, but the other super important note that most entrepreneurs forget, or most people that are starting in sales forget, how vital it is to have a relationship first with whoever you're selling to before you try and sell to them. I mean, I know that we can all say, okay, I've got this great product here, and or let's say my soy sauce product, okay? I've got a sample of soy sauce. I can go today and knock on the door at 25 restaurants, put a sample in front of them, say, hey, I'm great and I'm wonderful and try me. Well, they've already been using the same soy sauce maybe for 10 or 20 years. They have no reason to switch. The price is fine. The taste is fine. They don't know me. They don't know the brand. But on those 20, if I start to develop a relationship first through social media, through an email, through going to see them, and sometimes it can get expensive, and this is kind of a fun perk of my job, but I'll go into the restaurant, have dinner, have lunch, go there for happy hour, have a drink, get to know the staff, get to know the chef, make sure I'm wearing my shirt with my logo on it. And then it's like, by the way, I happen to have this soy sauce company. Here's a sample. What do you think? Well, then at that point, they know you. They feel comfortable with you. And, you know, I mean, just like right now is even an example of us being online here. You know, if you message me out of the blue, said you want to interview me, I know nothing about you. I don't know if you're for real or you're not for real, especially being so far away. But you and I have known each other for quite some time now and at least developed a relationship via social media and a few emails. So at least there's some common ground there to get to the point where I'm like, yeah, sure, podcast, 8:30, let's get on and do it. So
awesome.
Yeah, I mean, and it's really taking things home, but I think a lot of people get lazy, right? They want the easy way. And I always try, I'm similar, like, yeah, I like building relationships and knowing people and then doing business. But I think a lot of times people do the opposite, right? They get excited about a product and they try to just spam message everybody they could potentially be their customer and get frustrated easily. So yeah, I thanks for sharing that with us. And that's really cool. So then, yeah, I mean, and it seems like a fun thing, right? You get to go meet a lot of awesome people and make new friends and do business everywhere. And yeah.
It's an interesting business to be in the food business that we're in now because, you know, pretty much, you know, like whenever we do taste tests with chefs or other restaurant buyers, you know, probably about 99% of the time we're picked number one in taste tests, which is pretty cool. But, you know, another business I had many years ago, well, probably almost 15 years ago that I mentioned called Mach 5. Part of that business was legal services. So we served subpoenas, citations, lawsuits. And in that business, you're pissing people off. You're making people mad. You're handing them a subpoena or lawsuit to appear at court. And even though we made our client happy, which was the law firm, you know, that business, it's a stressful. I mean, all businesses are stressful. I don't care what you're doing or selling, but there's different types of businesses. So I've kind of learned over the years, just in my nature, that I prefer to be in a business where you're making people happy and excited about what you're doing. Still hard work. I mean, it's still, you know, I mean, my work weeks now are down probably to 60 hours or so now, but I went for a stretch where I was 80 to 100 hours or more a week, working for probably almost a year. And, you know, a couple months ago, I started to slow down a little bit. So if you call 60 hours a week slowing down.
I know, right? I'm like, yeah. I think people are going to be able to. Yeah, but exactly. That's what it takes to build a business, right? And I think. Cool. So then, yeah, and I've seen your social media and you always have some, you know, fun pictures and some attractive women, and that's it's a good mix, and trade shows and how did you figure your branding image and maybe some tips on like getting some how do you call it, like models or spokeswomen or spokespeople?
Yeah. So putting that up front with the old sales adage of sex sells, and I know it's that term probably not used as often now, but no matter how you chop it up, just about no matter what part of the world that you're in, especially America, that does work. It only works to a point though, but with the, I'll start with the branding first. So the name Little Soya, soy sauce in many countries, China, Mexico, Canada, and several others, is called Soya, S-O-Y-A. Here in the U.S., it's just S-O-Y. But when I decided to officially start the soy sauce company, I told myself, look, I'm about to be doing battle with multi-billion dollar old dinosaur companies, you know, that are already out there. They're already established, unlimited marketing budgets. And I've got to create a name and a brand that can stand alone by itself and talk to the customer without me being there. You know, it's one thing if I'm standing there saying, we're great, we're wonderful, taste it, and here's a sample, versus just having the bottle of soy sauce on the shelf at the store or a restaurant chef flipping through his catalog and looking for a different product to buy. So Little Soya, I thought the name was cute, unique, and funny. I thought it was a little bit catchy. I wanted to design a brand that had personality. And so I came up with the name, and amazingly, it was available. The .com was available. The Twitter address, interestingly, was owned by a 16-year-old Korean girl in Korea, her parents or family called her Little Soya forever. Huh. And I wanted the name from her. So I messaged her several times to get it back from her, or to get it from her, and she wouldn't give it to me because she owned it. Offered her $50 and then $100 US, and she wouldn't listen. Finally, I had my Korean girlfriend at the time write her a letter, and we convinced her to give it up. Awesome. But anyway, we're not on video now, but if someone wants to go later to our website and look at what I'm talking about, our website is littlesoya.com. So that's littlesoya.com. And you'll see our brand there, which are the logo for Little Soya. Believe it or not, when I was looking for a graphic designer, I'd interviewed about 10 different Asian graphic designers. I wanted an American-born Asian graphic designer, because that's where my product primarily was going to be sold. But I also wanted them to have Asian influence, certainly specifically Chinese influence. And that's what I found. So I found one designer that his expertise was cartoon illustration. And I went to him and I said, look, I'm just going to tell you one thing, and then you go back and do your drawing. And I said, I want you to combine Hello Kitty and Wendy's.
Wendy's hamburgers.
In the U.S. So because I wanted to merge the iconic American brand with the iconic Asian brand. And our Asian logo. And that's what they did.
Cool.
So we put the name together. We put the brand together, put the colors, you know, the green, which green signifies, you know, healthier, eco-friendly, that sort of thing. And then in the beginning, especially, and you are right to notice the pretty females, we used to call them our Little Soya girls. Most of them I met online on Twitter or on Facebook, or I would see them on Instagram. There was this one girl, she had like, 50,000 followers on Twitter at the time. Today, I think she's got like 400,000. On Instagram, I think she had 15 or 20,000 followers. And I noticed that it seemed like all she did in her pictures was repping different products, but they were all cool products. One was some surf shirts or surf or skateboard company. Another was a liquor company. One was athletic apparel. Another protein drink or healthy supplement type company. So I just contacted her and said, hey, if I send you some product, would you be willing to take some pictures with our product? And she said, yeah, send me some shirts, send me some product, and send me a check for $250. And I thought, okay, I mean, I didn't know her. Okay, I'm going to send this girl $250 and a bunch of free product, and I'm never going to hear from her again. And, sadly took a chance, but I had communicated with her for a while and felt that she was kind of, or should be, one of our first folks models. And it worked out great. So she immediately took pictures out with friends at restaurants, out on the weekend. She'd eaten at a restaurant. She would have our shirt on, have one of our little single-use fish packets like she was using it. She'd have her friend take a picture, and she would post it, and then she would tag that all over the place.
Awesome.
And then copied that same thing. She was in Miami. And then my second one was in L.A. She's actually a stunt girl there. Girl's unbelievable. I'll send you her link to her later. Her stunt woman name is Peppa the Hot Steppa.
How do they come up with this stuff? It's awesome.
I don't know. Yeah. So she's been in like Nike commercials, Doritos commercials, a couple of different airlines, the big insurance companies. And she's just awesome. And she's Chinese by background. She's half Chinese and half white. So it was just or half American. So it was just kind of a good mix there. And then we just kind of kept that going. And then even hiring staff in the beginning, it worked out. But really my first sales rep was a gal named Crystal Lee. She now represents us up in New York. But she had already done modeling in the past. She was already quite attractive. She was already had a great attitude. Because, you know, it's one thing hiring models or for social media that are going to take a picture, smile, people are going to see it and, you know, hopefully want to buy your product. And it's a totally different thing to have them working for you. They can't just have the looks. They got to have the looks and the brains too. And so luckily Crystal had that. And then a couple other employees after her, I kind of worked it the same way. And yeah, as far as the brand goes, we just wanted a brand that was fun, that was, you know, like I said, personable, and could speak to a customer without us being right there in front of them.
Cool. No, I think you're doing a great job. And yeah, I always like you guys are always creative on your posts, and it gets my attention too. So definitely, I think going the right way. And we'll try to link up some of those, you know, social media and other things we talked about. Yeah, I mean, I guess we're kind of, you know, you're really busy, so I really appreciate your time. So maybe a tip for somebody want to start out like international business and maybe trying to build up a brand like you've done, what would they do maybe to get started or on the right track?
So several quick things. I know some of this is somewhat cliche, but I would really start off with focusing on what they really like, what they really enjoy. And I know this is so old school to say it like this, but it's really about getting a white sheet of paper and a pen or pencil and just sketching out on their, you know, notes on what direction you think you might want to go, what products you think you might want to sell, what service you might want to be able to offer. And on that, so if you got your laptop up and it's your Apple or whatever it is, and you're write your notes on there, that's fine. But it's just kind of free form thoughts. So instead of picking one particular industry or one particular product or one service and just going for it, you know, really spend some time, spend a couple months time researching. And especially if possible, I know people don't believe me often when I say this, but find someone who's already doing it and go talk to them. Find out how hard it is. Find out how well they're doing. Find out how big they are. Find out how profitable it is. Find out, you know, how they got started. And you'd be so surprised to find out how willing people are to talk about their business And I mean, just like this conversation here, I mean, yeah, I am busy, but I didn't mind taking out an hour to tell you about some of my history and how I got started. Some of the information some people might say is privileged or even confidential, but it's kind of already out there. So, you know, if I had not started a company before ever, I would also be really, really careful how much money it costs to start a company and do your absolute best to, I mean, there's two different ways to go about it. So you can start off small and kind of like I did with Arista Global that I mentioned when I opened the China sourcing company in Vegas. You know, I had a website built for maybe $1,000 US, you know, had some really nice business cards made up, and I just went out there and made it look like that I already had an established company. And, you know, my invoices that I had for customers, it was just from some online site. That's one way to do it. And then the other way, which is the much more expensive way that I did with Little Soya, you know, is looking for investors to raise money, which is extremely difficult, very time consuming. And, you know, if you're recently married or have a newborn like you do, you better have a wife who believes in you and mm-hmm. Cut off for a long, long period. But so I guess just to kind of sum that up, to just really focus in the beginning on just spending time researching. Don't just jump into it and do it.
Got it. That sounds good, but at the same time, you know, some people never stop researching. So I think there's got to be a little bit of a balance to.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's another thing that I learned from a business mentor of mine many years back, that whatever business that you're going to start or whatever product that you're thinking of launching or service or whatever, it's never going to be perfect. And especially if you're somewhat of a perfectionist like I am, you can get caught up in that and get too focused on the detail of whatever product or service that is. And one thing I've learned is, you know, you've probably heard me use the term business mentor several times in this conversation. I probably have about 6 or 7 different mentors that I've picked up throughout the years that are basically go-to guys that have already been in business 20 or 30 years. They've already been down the roads before. They've already been down dead ends. And that's what I want. I want someone who can tell me where the dead ends are. I want someone who can tell me where the landmines are so that I don't have to experience what they experienced. Because, you know, like quite often people will ask me, you know, the right recipe for success or the right recipe for business success. And, you know, I can't often tell you the path to go down, but I can tell you the path not to go down. So, yeah. So, but to your point, yeah, you know, if you're going to spend a couple months research, that's fine. Sometimes it is just like the Apple company, you know, how they are sometimes, or even other computer companies, Microsoft even, you know, heck, you know how it is. I mean, they'll just put a product out there in the beginning and get a flood of customers telling them this is not working and there's an error here. And this is, well, that's how they learn.
Yeah.
And they perfect it and get it better and better and better. So sure, spend time on it, but don't get it to the point where it's perfect. And then you're going to, because then you're going to start missing customers.
Exactly.
Your number one goal is to get the money in the bank, right?
Yeah, I think that's when I think a business is started, is when the first customer pays, right? Maybe.
Yeah. Because you can talk all day about it and research all day and be online all day and all that. But until money changes hands, you know, nothing else matters. And once it does change hands, and once you see it hit your bank for that first time, that makes it all worth it.
Yeah, it's such a great feeling for that new business when it's, you know, validation is money in the bank. For sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, Gary. So yeah, again, I know I really appreciate your sharing today. And so we know littlesoya.com for people to check out it. And then you're pretty active on social media, and how can people maybe reach out to you, or should I just go to website, or what do you?
Yeah, there are several ways. Probably the easiest would be through the Little Soya website in the U.S. I'll be on Facebook, and you can find me on, it'll be facebook.com /GaryKnows. So that's GaryKnows. I'm also on LinkedIn that you can find me on.
Yeah. We'll link that on the notes too so that people can get it. Awesome, Gary. So thanks again and enjoy your time in Houston.
All righty. Thank you so much, Mike, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, great.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks for coming on, Gary. Really appreciate it. And I know entrepreneurs out there are going to get off their butts and start taking some action from this. So thanks again for sharing so openly. And for those that appreciated it, please don't be shy and reach out to Gary and give him a quick thanks. Also, maybe tell your local restaurants to start carrying the Little Soya brand. Let's get this thing rocking. Okay, now for a quick announcement. I've decided to make this show be every other week. I just want to make sure I keep the quality of the show as high as possible and keep my momentum going. Many listeners are enjoying the show, but say they have trouble keeping up as it's so many episodes every week. So I am also having trouble keeping up, and I thought listeners are overwhelmed and I'm overwhelmed. Let's maybe just tune it down a little bit. So I'm going to do it every other week, and I'm looking forward to keep going with the show, and it'll be still on Tuesday mornings, 10 a.m. Hong Kong time, just every other Tuesday. Also, I'm pretty busy preparing for my U.S. trip. I'm going to be busy trip landing in San Francisco on September 11th at 9 a.m., a couple days there, Florida. Most of the time until September 24th, a few days in New York and Connecticut until the 28th, and then back to China on September 29th. Yeah, I know it's going to be pretty hyper. I'm used to doing this on my own, but now with a wife and kid, it's going to be a new experience, so wish me luck. All right, that's all we have for today's show. Thanks for being here with me, and I will see you in 2 weeks. Time to take Miles off for a bike ride. He loves bike rides. Bye-bye.
To get more info about running an international business via Hong Kong, please visit our website at www.globalfromasia.com. That's www.globalfromasia.com. Also, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes feed. Thanks for tuning in.